And welcome to In-Game Chat for Saturday, July 27th, 2013. This is Season 7, Episode 25. I'm Scott.
I'm James.
And I'm RJ.
And welcome to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our phone number is 334-272-9228. 334-272-9228. You can find us on Twitter and at In-Game Chat, as well as on Facebook. You can email us, everyone, at ingamechat.net. And we're streaming the cam feed right now through Twitch TV, and you can find us there as well as join the chat room live while we broadcast. So welcome to the show. I've been an interesting week that's sort of only developed in the past few days, and then more so just today before we came on the show. So what we're looking at here is earlier in the week, actually yesterday, I'll get to that, the PS4, Sony announced, well, Digital Foundry had some insight into how the RAM of the PS4 is going to be allocated for use of developers and what the operating system is going to be used as. And there's been updates that have been coming in today as to how all of that will work. So we'll get to that in just a minute. Earlier this week, Microsoft threw another 180 at us on their policies and announced that independent devs could self-publish their own titles on the Xbox One. In fact, something to the statement of that every Xbox One is pretty much a dev kit. And this was received well by some and not by others. And as an extension of that, today there was... It only recently broke, so I'm not exactly sure on the details, but from what I understand... a guy by the name of Marcus Beer, is that correct?
Yes.
Over at Game Trailers.
He has his own very, very character-oriented show that he produces, usually on a once-a-week basis over at Game Trailers, as one of their little short-format small pieces, where he is the annoyed gamer.
Right.
He's a guy that I've listened to, you know, occasionally, off and on for a while. It's easily digestible. It's only about 10 minutes a pop once a week. And he is a games industry personality, you know, a bit of a critic, not really a journalist, just one of these guys who is a pundit, right? He's gaming's version of the regular faces that you see on political cable news television, that sort of thing. And he was guesting on Invisible Walls, which is one of the more long format discussion programs that they have over on Game Trailers. And he was referencing something that I wasn't even aware of. And I haven't been able to find, mention exactly direct quotes of the things that apparently got him so upset. And being upset, just go ahead and put this out there. Being upset is kind of what he does. It's very much in character for his thing,
mm-hmm.
but he seems to always be in character. I don't know. He decides to call out very specifically Phil Fish, independent game developer, creator of Fez, and Jonathan Blow, who is the creator of Braid, currently working on The Witness. And those were two of the people when Game Informer earlier this week, I guess it was this week, correct? About 5 days ago.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, I know what you're
saying.
Game
Informer broke the story on Microsoft changing its stance where self-publishing on indies is concerned. And we should point out, if there's anybody who isn't familiar with what this entire thing is about, there was a lot of differentiation between how these two consoles were going to handle independent developers, independent game makers, or small studios, I guess. Anybody that doesn't have a direct relationship with or is not owned by a large publishing house, right? And 5, 6, 7 years ago, this wasn't a problem because this kind of thing wasn't happening. How it worked on the PC was entirely different. There's some great stories that came out if you followed the growth of things like World of Goo, you know, earlier, several years ago, back when all of this stuff was really only happening on the PC. But because the consoles have changed so much, the question of how... And in what way these consoles are going to help independent developers is really serious, because there's been a lot of good and bad happening in the consoles already. And as anybody who pays any attention to this industry can tell you, it's been stormy seas over at Microsoft. Microsoft just doesn't come off as being very indie friendly. And if you want to be published over there, you have to let Microsoft have complete access and ownership and distribution rights and everything to all of your titles, right? Which isn't really one of the reasons that I think independent developers are doing what they're doing. These are, you know, these guys look at themselves more like craftsmen, like small batch artisans, you know? So anyway, how those two companies are going to treat this type of developer in the next generation is very, very important. It's a huge question to everybody. And it looked for a time like Sony was being absolutely magnanimous. They had been very generous with their terms. They had created the pub fund to help some of these smaller guys get a little bit of a boost, get a little bit of money underneath them so that they could start developing. And the terms seemed fair. And meanwhile, it didn't look like Microsoft was doing anything to help them. And we knew for a time that there was going to be no self-publishing. You want to self-publish? Too bad. You have to sell your soul in order to get your game made on our system. That's obviously bad news for them, and a chain of nothing but bad news for them since the 21st of May. So they had come around to reducing the restrictions and changing their position and saying that indeed we are going to allow some kind of self-publishing. And this is a tough story, obviously, right? This is a tough thing. They have done nothing but get caught off balance where stories regarding their policies are concerned. So my understanding is Game Informer goes and in preparation for breaking the story decides to talk to a couple of people who have made successful independent games and worked on Microsoft's platform. Seems very obvious mm-hmm. that you go to two of the biggest names, Jonathan Blow and Phil Fish. And apparently, this is the part I haven't been able to find, Phil Fish in particular, just instead of saying no comment and turning away, was sort of, I don't know, grotesque in his dismissal of the whole thing. Or he took an opportunity to just say, don't bother me with this. Why are you bothering me? Like, why would you come to me with this? Stop bothering me. Mm-hmm. Don't talk to me. And Phil is a very particular kind of guy. He's very fractious. He's very sensitive. He doesn't seem to handle criticism very well. A lot of people are convinced that this is some sort of amazing put on, but mostly the guy just seems like someone who can't self-edit very well in places like Twitter. Hmm. So when he responds like that, it's like chum in the water for the people on the other side of the industry, for the people in what we refer to as the journalistic side, which isn't really journalism, more the punditry and the critics. And Beer took the opportunity to call him out on that. And he said a lot of grotesque things himself. He used a lot of really bad words, called Jonathan Blow and Phil Fish a lot of really, you know, silly names, like stupid things that aren't even terribly creative. But whatever. Some of it was fine. It's very much in his personality. It's very much what he does. He wasn't stepping outside of himself or his usual coverage. Like, it's what he does. He says terrible things, and he, you know, goes too far one direction or another. And then that bounces back all the way the other direction, where Phil Fish just decides to pour more gasoline on the fire and start throwing his toys out of the pram. And evidently canceling the sequel to his game, packing up the whole shop, taking the money with him, I guess, and disappearing down a rabbit hole. Like, that's what it looks like right now. Mm. And it's, if this were a real story about real things, it would be super fascinating because it's actually happening right now as we talk about it, developing right in the various places on the internet. And I can't really seem to decide whether the honest cancellation of a game because of personality problems is the better story, or, and this is what I tend to, the relationship between the creators and the pundits and the critics and the journalists, the people who make games and the people who talk about games. And I think that's actually the far more interesting thing here, because if you could somehow neutralize all of the acid in this conversation, if you could somehow get rid of the personality conflicts and the problems, the disposition of the creator and the professional angst of the pundit. If you could get all of that out of the way and just talk about what it is, I am ever so slightly not on Marcus Beer's side, but I am slightly more interested in what he had to say. And it was probably a very defensive thing. And we are simply a much less successful version of what a lot of those guys are doing anyway. But
right.
He made it very clear that, and this is the only part about it that I actually thought was terribly valid. It's that you belittle us. You act as if we are parasites, but you need us. All of us, those of us who do it voluntarily, those of us who you have begged for exposure. We have had the opportunity on this show, on this program, right, which is a very small thing in the world. We have had the opportunity to talk to people so far beyond our ability, so mm-hmm. far above us or out of our price range, simply because they all understand how incredibly important it is to be able to distribute your message and the information about your game in a world that is choked with information. You think it would be easy to get the word out, to clarify something, to talk about some detail of your game, or to just simply sit down and chat with some guys about your labor of love. You would think that would be easy, but it isn't. And they have to work so hard to cross that threshold for the first time, particularly for the first time.
Yeah.
They clearly understand how desperately they need the world of information to be distributing their thing. And I believe that Marcus was simply pointing out that he not forget that it is extremely important to have people talking about your game. And when people have a concept that seems very directly related to your life up to this point as a developer, why are you annoyed that they've come to you? Why are you upset? Why can't you just be a little bit more gracious? He certainly didn't say it anything like that, of course, because obviously this has to be the clash of the, you know, of giant babies online in a horrible, horrible place to do it. Because
yeah, the reason they want to talk to you is because you're an authority on the matter,
right? Like how are you not? How can you be in a place in your life where you are being openly and eagerly recognized as an authority on some concept, and you just don't have time for it? I mean.
Sounds like you want it both ways. You can't have it that way.
And you can't have it both ways. And I think that's what Beer was trying to say. But instead, he was being reactionary. And then Phil Fish is reactionary. And apparently, again, apparently, closed up shop. Tweeted that he's done. I'm out. He dropped the mic. He stopped development on the game. Then tweeted from the official Twitter account of his company that said it's done. Apparently has confirmed it behind the scenes. The thing about this guy is that doesn't matter. He could confirm it
right
at the top of every hour for the next week, and then everybody wouldn't be shocked when he just came back and was like, oh, I'm going to start it back up again. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Because he is the type of dude who reacts in this way. This is what he does. I don't think it's some grandmaster plan. I don't think he's an amazing puppeteer or a performer. I don't think it's in jest, but I don't think he's serious. I think he's just a guy who doesn't manage himself very well publicly. He didn't get to his position through years and years of servitude and arduous managerial work. He didn't grow to a position of authority and power. He didn't become the mouthpiece of a company because he has proved himself an able communicator and, you know, a steady hand at the wheel. He's a guy who lifted himself up and went through some pretty terrible circumstances and apparently became a more terrible person along the way and is the mouthpiece of his company for the same reason any of us can be the mouthpiece of anything, because he has the fortune of being a young professional in the early 21st century, and there you go. So he is granted a lot of authority on certain matters, but he just doesn't have the temperament. You know, he's just ill-tempered. And you've put him up against a guy who is professionally ill-tempered, which I'm actually, I even think Beer is okay. I think for the most part, he's not trippy. He doesn't get in front of the camera and just go off in a general direction. He tries to have some concept, and then, you know, a lot of times I agree with him. And I can understand how difficult that is to do. To step in front of a recording device and just run your mouth.
Got some experience there, do you?
I do have some experience at doing very badly at it. So I can understand it. I am a little bit done with the professional cynic because I don't think it's helpful. There is so much natural cynicism, like binding everything together in the world as it is right now, that I don't think any manufactured cynicism is called for.
Mm-hmm.
There are some very clear things to talk about here, and it really is not about the righteousness of the indie or whether they're stupid hipsters or anything like that, whether they're too big for their britches or whether the media is more important than the creators or it's really the gamers that matter or any of it. It doesn't really... We are so ill-equipped for this conversation. Even those of us, the amateur and professional appreciators, are ill-equipped to really be critical of the things that we love. We are all too heavily invested in it, and we haven't developed a way to not just talk like adults. We're all very passionate about this. It's all a very passion-oriented thing. Of course, I get a little out of my mind with things, and so should everybody else. Well, not should necessarily, but it can be forgiven. These aren't boring. We don't do this because it's boring. We don't play games because they don't inspire us and enrage us, right? We do it because they light different fires in each and every one of us for different reasons. And that kind of works its way into just the general dialogue of, hey, where's my game? You know?
Yeah.
And so we begin to misidentify certain things and we begin to misunderstand things and we begin to craft our own narratives about what's happening in the industry, right? And begin to believe that that word even comes close to encompassing everything that's going on. But the lines aren't very clear, and the relationships aren't very strict and don't have to be very professional at all times. And they must, in other times, be incredibly professional, and none of us is good enough, really, to keep those things where they should be. I know we laugh an awful lot at people like... I mean, this is just a thought off the top of my head, but a guy's like Jeff Keighley, right? For just being so clinical and so, you know, clean and telegenic and not just real in the way that we feel like we want real representation in talking about games. But the guy stays balanced. And that's a very hard thing to do. And it's a very rare thing to do. And it's the type of thing that I don't think have enough of. I think we could use more of that. And, frankly... less people like us. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but in general, that's kind of what I'm saying. This whole concept of games journalism, it's fair to say it doesn't exist. It's an incredibly difficult field in which to conduct journalism, to be investigative, to get people to talk to you in secret or off the record. These things don't work the same way they do in traditional media.
Correct. Because there is there's that big wall of... PR. There's that big wall of do not talk about this, or we're not ready to talk about this, or we cannot talk about this.
Or I'll be hung by my toes if I'm caught talking about this.
I'm going to lose a lot of money if I talk about this, or that sort of situation. I'm going to lose my job if I talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah. And not only lose my job, but it's a relatively... it's an enormous industry in terms of the money generated. But it's not a huge... It's not an unimaginably... large industry where you consider the ability to know other people. Lots of people know lots of people. Mm-hmm. You make a bad name for yourself, that's going to follow. That goes on your permanent record. You got to be careful.
Bad news travels quickly.
Yes, yeah. It does. And you have to be very, very careful about that. And so it's not that I'm not understanding in that respect, but I think that the industry itself does not lend itself to what we want to consider to be journalism. It mostly just turns into editorializing. We do it too. But I can also say that for a long time, and this is mostly because we're all very old, we've been concerned about trying to find a better way to have these discussions. Not just, we don't like link bait stuff. We don't like controversial things. We did in years past, but they're not good for the long-term health of the participants or the thing that we're participating in. And this thing, whether the closure of the game is real or not, that's a separate issue. Maybe it needs to go away. Maybe the guy needs to find his center and get a little bit more balanced. Maybe he needs to, I don't know. Maybe he needs somebody there to slam his laptop shut on his fingers when he starts to go into Twitter. I don't know what. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is so elaborate and such a magnificently crafted, you know, farce. I don't know. Maybe it is legit. I don't know. But even if it is, that almost makes it worse.
Calgar99 in the chat room says that he's surprised that public meltdowns like this don't happen more often, considering that those people are faced by hundreds of comments and messages each day, just, you know, poo-pooing their game, their hard work, and everything.
Well, I think a lot of folks know better than to go public and have a meltdown like that, especially in this day and age. They can't do anything but hurt you.
That, and to take it too seriously in that regard as to, you know, everything everybody else has said, you know. It's not necessarily find the good in everything. It's don't go out there and just read the good reviews and stuff like that and ignore the negatives.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a sense of, you have to look at it in a way of, hey, maybe we can make this better next time, or I need to fix on this situation, whatever the case is, but not to let that get to... And God, easier said than done, I suppose.
It is incredibly hard to suffer criticism.
The best we got are some iTunes reviews.
Even honest criticism of your... When you do anything, when you expose yourself in any way, your opinions, your passions, your ideas, and your ideals, in any way... You are, in a manner of speaking, no longer the owner of those things. You put them out there for judgment. If you intend anything you ever do for consumption, then it is also intended for judgment. That's very naturally what it is. That doesn't stop the criticism being difficult, particularly when the criticism doesn't align with what you think of yourself. And any creator is a harsh critic of himself. That's just the case. It's just the case, even if it's done privately. And... You know, I have to believe, I got to believe in the most composed, the most professional, the most judicious game developer in the world, responsible. I have to believe that there's a little tiny Phil Fish jumping up and down inside the hearts of even guys like Neil Druckmann. There has to be.
Oh, yeah.
That desperation, that part of you that makes you a creator, that part of you that makes you able to conjure amazing works, is also the part of you most... You cannot have a thick skin around the part of you that creates. You'll be stony and worthless. You have to expose yourself in order to create, and that means that you suffer damage. And you just got to hope that you have a pocket healer nearby or something. I don't know how to continue that metaphor, but, you know, the point is that what Phil's doing, again, whether it's whatever it is, I don't know. There is something legitimate in it, and I promise you there's some element of it in any other person anywhere who suffered criticism for their work. So, it's the dialogue, man. I don't want to sound like a hippie, but it's the dialogue there that's necessary. We've got to find a better way to talk to each other, right? There's got to be a way to spar and to fence without drawing blood.
Yeah.
And without just turning people off. What a gross display. What a terrible display. And I would never want to drag somebody else who's at the fringes of gaming and who maybe wants to understand why I'm in it so deep as I am. I would never want to drag them closer to this conversation. Look at what a grand example of my pastime this is.
Right. Mm. I understand what you're saying. You could see that mostly on Twitter, especially after it sort of died down. Everybody said, I'm just going to go play games tonight and have some fun rather than look at all this, the hatred and back and forth and everything else going on. The snark, the snipe, and everything else that's happening. So, but yeah, there's the situation at hand. Anyway, we're going to take our first break of the hour, and then when we come back, we will have more of In-Game Chat. We will be right back. And welcome back to In-Game Chat. Well, if you were trying to guess what that was, Lavos got it. Actually, it's Stufu and Lavos got it in the chat room.
Chrono Cross, one of the victory themes.
It is. Victory Call of Summer.
Call of Summer. And then there is another one, a much softer, like fluty one or something like that. Mm. But yes, Chrono Cross, really good soundtrack.
Yeah, that was Chrono Cross. And welcome back to In-Game Chat. Moving on to the next story here was the situation that kind of unfolded yesterday and then more so today. Digital Foundry got a hold of some information as to how the RAM of the PS4 will be allocated. And we know it's getting 8 gigs of GDDR5 is what we knew the PS4 would have.
Right.
Microsoft has 8 gigs as well of DDR3. Correct.
Which is what is typically used as system memory, as basic system RAM in a computer. GDDR5 is a refresher, mm-hmm. is the high bandwidth RAM that's almost exclusively used for GPUs on the PC.
And what we knew already was that we knew how Microsoft was going to use those 8 gigs for gaming and for the OS.
For the most part, yeah. At least we had a rough idea of how they were going to distribute it. And, you know, for a long time, I cannot find this. Maybe someone else can. I didn't give myself enough time to do it. For some time, right, there's been an assumption, just a general idea, that, okay, they've each got 8 gigabytes of RAM in their system. I think we'll all just stipulate that we understand why having a lot of RAM in a gaming system now is a big deal, what we've learned in the past several years. There was an assumption that because of what Microsoft is doing on their system, running with the different operating environments that are going to help them with the fast switching and the pinning of different applications and all of the different things that they're claiming that their system is going to be able to do quite well, that they were going to have to dedicate a significant amount of system memory to that. Because again, remember, they are running two operating systems, they're running two virtual machines, two Hyper-V machines, and they are running a third hypervisor, a smaller operating system, in order to handle the switching between those things, right? So mm-hmm. when they tell you we're going to have X amount of RAM allocated for these operating systems, that makes an awful lot of sense. Seems perfectly fair. There was at some point some statement made, and I got to believe it came from not as a part of a presentation, but on or around the time they unveiled the machine. Mm-hmm. Some executive said something about how big they thought their OS footprint was going to be on the system. They didn't want it to get past, you know, a certain point. Not an official statement, but one of those, it came from the mouth of a Sony guy, so I think this is what they're doing. And it made us believe, at least based on what we've been told, that there was a possibility that 7-6 gigs of RAM could be allocated directly for games, that any individual game could be allowed up to possibly as much as 7 gigabytes of RAM. That being true, if it was true, is extraordinary. That doesn't even happen on the PC.
Yeah.
It never happens on the PC. And one of the only reasons to be hugely excited about a single game having that much access is that we're going to start moving into the world of 64-bit gaming applications where the games themselves are large address aware. They can recognize the large volumes of RAM you have in your system. This has been, you know, an issue of minor concern on the PC for a while now, mostly among power users who play high-end games and say, look, make a game specifically for my machine that uses up all the resources I'm willing to pay to put in there. And this isn't a place that most development teams are willing to go. It's not cost-effective. At this time, but here was the possibility of some evidence that that's going to start happening on the console, so maybe that influences what happens on the PC as well. Let's be clear. In general, more RAM for a game does not make the frame rates better. In general, more RAM does not necessarily make the AI or anything better. RAM is just space. It's just an amount of space that you have to work with. The game lives permanently on either the disk, you know, the CD, or on your hard drive. That's where the bulk of the data is. The GPU and the CPU have to process that stuff. They have to calculate all the things that need calculating, inputs and outputs, AI, lighting, physics, everything, okay? And then they have to throw it on your screen. The more RAM you have, the larger those individual assets you can work with. When we talk about the differences between the size of environments in PC gaming and in console gaming, when we talk about the detail of the textures, you know, how really crisp and amazing and high resolution the things are on PC and how much worse they sometimes appear on the consoles, how much longer the loading takes on consoles, how much more frequent it has a tendency to be. It isn't console bashing. It is almost always directly related to there not being enough memory to have a lot of assets in the immediately available pool. So when we talk about this, we're mostly just talking about getting to a point where these two types of games are much closer together, right? Whether the PS3 or the PS4 rather, or the Xbox One had more RAM allocated directly to games was not necessarily the issue because the systems are so close together anyway. It might mean that a slightly more difficult time was had by one development team or another or during one point in time, but none of us really knows that. It's a whole lot of guesswork. So when Sony clarifies that it looks like the system, what is the actual number that they clarified?
4.5
gigabytes of RAM
for the developers to use
purely for the access of the game. I thought
4.5,
and then what, another half gig?
Yeah, 512
megabytes.
So up to 5 gigs of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
There are, I think, two interesting things to say about this. One, they don't want to talk, and this is true, I believe, right? They don't want to say exactly what it is that their operating system is going to be doing. That all of this RAM is dedicated to, we're saying the operating system, right? We don't really know if it's the proper operating system or how many processes in the background is going to be using this RAM, right? Let's not make too many assumptions about what we know, because we've proven, if nothing else, over the last several months, that we don't actually know all that much, and that it's very easy for a simple piece of incomplete information to turn into a game of telephone, and then for everybody to take deductive leaps,
right,
which are unwarranted, and then tell themselves things that aren't true. So when we say, well, they're keeping so much for the OS, I'm suspicious that it is all strictly for just straight OS type stuff. We know for a fact that the PS3 suffered because it didn't have enough RAM on the whole, but they didn't leave themselves much room to play with, because in the early days of the PS3, there was no cross-game chat. There was no ability to access the UI, the cross-media bar, from within a game.
That's right. Yeah.
You could do none of these things, and they had to work very, very hard to pare down the footprint of their basic operating environment in order to squeeze in extra operations, extra things that they hadn't thought of. If we're going to assume that a lot of what they're doing here is maintaining a batch of memory for stuff we're not talking about, stuff we're not sure about,
right,
stuff that's still cooking, things that we don't want to have to pare away the basic operating experience for, right? Because if we're very honest, I like the design of the PlayStation's user interface. I think it's clean. I think it is direct. I think it's no nonsense. And I think it is largely clear of advertisements because of how it's designed. It is also very laggy, very sluggy, very difficult to tolerate. It's much more sluggish than the Xbox, and both of them are inexcusably slow compared to what happens on the PC. So knowing that experience that didn't really exist before, right? Because the PS3 at its launch, was a thing you slide a disc into and play a game. That's it. We have grown into a world of massive digital stores, bloated and complicated user interfaces, cloud saves and uploads, cross-device play, all of these different things.
Background downloading,
all of this stuff. There needs to be room for stuff you don't know that you're going to need. So if I look at it like that, it's somewhat excusable. If I look at it that they simply mean that there are portions of memory being allocated to other processes that are going to help the PS4 be the complete machine it wants to be, also, I suppose, fair enough. The other thing is, and again, let's just remind ourselves that we don't know enough. There's a lot of things they're not talking about because, as per our previous half hour, they don't talk. Nobody wants to tell you anything. So the other thing is, when I heard this story yesterday, I opened up the resource monitor on my PC. And I have 8 gigs of RAM in my machine. It's a pretty decent gaming machine. I run two monitors. I had Guild Wars 2, Skype, Fraps, about 24 Chrome tabs, a remote desktop connection to work, I think another voice chat client, Steam, handful of other things all running, tons and tons of stuff running, more things running, and a very resource-hungry game running at the same time than a console will ever do. I did not break 5 gigs of RAM being used on my machine. Any concept that only having 5 to 6 gigabytes available on a console like this for the game, any concept that that's a real problem just isn't, shouldn't be entertained right now. I don't really think it's anything to be worried about. I can tell you right now that I run tons of garbage. I run everything at the highest possible settings, doing all the things I possibly can, crammed up the wazoo with mods and high def texture packs, anything I can possibly do. And my system is still clicking right along with 3 gigs spare. And that's, you know, counting my Windows and everything else. So,
yeah, now see, that was my initial thought looking at this article, was that are they going to have enough to do what they want with this game? Because, see, I'm not as PC gaming savvy as the two of you. So when I heard that they were going to have less than what they thought, I thought the developers weren't going to have what they were weren't going to have the resources necessary to do what they want. But with your explanation, that's not really an issue to even concern yourself with.
No, I, as a matter of fact, I don't think that there is, at this point right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to assume that the developers that have dev kits know more about it than I do, and I think they probably have a very clear understanding that what Sony has done is very much allocated a lot of space for everything necessary to run the system, and given them again, there's still a lot of things we don't know, and it's possible that if we redefine certain phrases, or if they're redefined for us,
yeah,
then that 5 gigs could maybe turn into 6, you know, depending on how things are. But let's just call it 5 for right now. I don't think anybody's going to be upset about 5. I really, really don't. I don't think it's a perfect comparison, but if you look at Steam hardware surveys, I don't know if you've ever done those.
No.
The Steam client routinely takes it's opt-in.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Okay.
But they take surveys of the machines running the Steam client, right? Because it's like, hey, Steam is a gaming-centric thing. We'd like to know where everybody sits. So
we can find out what graphics cards people are using, the OSs that people are using.
Exactly. How much RAM they have, mm-hmm. which types of processor, all of this different stuff. And you can look at different percentages. By far, the overwhelming majority of people, at least the last time I looked, were running 4 gigs. 4 gigs is just some kind of standard. 8 is no trouble to get anymore because PC RAM is very, very cheap.
Yeah.
You may as well go for 8 if you're going for 4. And on the PC, it makes perfect sense. You can keep throwing Chrome tabs and streaming applications, you know, more Netflix or Hulu windows, more YouTube tabs, all of this stuff. You keep throwing it at it, and there's plenty of space for that stuff to keep working and not affecting your games. But I just don't think anybody should be particularly upset. I think the worst part about it is that we have to kind of reorganize our own perceptions, because we'd have had this one concept that, this is a significant difference between these two consoles.
Right.
5 gigs addressable over here, 7 gigs addressable over here. And, you know, that's just not true. But even if you did count that as an advantage over the Xbox, it is the advantage of least importance. Those 5 gigs are still GDDR5.
Mm-hmm.
The GPU is still a more powerful GPU. The rest of it, we can't really say. You know, we know that Microsoft is doing environment switching. We don't know everything about what Sony's doing. There's the question about how much streaming data each system is going to cache, which I actually don't understand very well.
That's the Sony gets the 15 minutes and Microsoft gets 5. Is that what we heard? It was
something like that. But again, yeah. I'm telling you, that piece of information smells as incomplete to me and not wholly realized as just about anything else we've heard. I'm betting you that when the reality shows up, it'll be enough different that it won't have mattered.
And something like that, I believe, was also stated that, look, if we want to increase that, we can. We just patch it through, and then it records 15 minutes of your last gameplay for you to share and do whatever with. I don't think it was something that was completely fixed. I think it was in there, but or set at that. But I don't think it's a fixed, set in stone type of situation. So, and from what I understand, the RAM situation may be for the PS4 anyway. Maybe the same thing. Someone mentioned in the chat room, we're quoting an article where the RAM allocations for the Xbox One were fixed at what they are. This is it. This is how it's going to be, and it cannot be changed. Whereas we either do not know that that's the case with the PS4, or we do know that they can give and take here and there to use it, you know, as needed. So again, Sony really hasn't commented on how their RAM is going to use, or how the OS is going to use their RAM or anything like that. They didn't want to discuss it. It's like we said with the same thing with the Microsoft reversal of the indie game policy. They weren't ready to spill complete details yet. Gamescom is coming up, and that's when they would be talking more about that situation. So over time, we're going to hear more about these things. It's a lot of the times whenever we're putting together shows like this, if there's an announcement that we'll know more about this coming up later, that's why I never put it in there, because I'm like, there's no point in even talking about it if we're going to get more information next week or 2 weeks from now at whatever. We can speculate all day, and we did that leading up to E3, leading up to the Microsoft press conference, leading up to the Sony press conference. Everything else, speculate, only to find out that you were completely wrong, completely right, or in the case of Microsoft, both, after they, you know, did their flip. So we don't know where that's at as far as officially. We've got good ideas, but officially, again...
Specs have always mattered. Some people don't care about them, okay? And I believe me, I understand why. If it's a lively, fun discussion about a bunch of guys sitting around talking about... Look, computer guys who care about specs talk about specs on computers like guys talk about tuning cars. It really is the same thing. Car guys and largely computer type guys are very much the same type of people, and they're interested in the same things for the same reasons. But there are certain people who don't care. It's just like, I want the best games because I don't want to have to learn an entire arcane subculture to understand why it is everybody's saying that the PS4 is better than the Xbox One. But and that's fine. But if they don't, we still have to recognize that specs have always mattered. Details of performance have always mattered.
Oh yeah.
Whether you personally care or not. Even if the thing with the better specs doesn't wind up being the most successful system, it matters because why? If it was more powerful, what exactly was happening to cause benefit to another company? Mm-hmm. Having said that, They know, right? They know that certain of us care about specs. They know that specs are going to get reported in the media, and they know that wild fictions are going to be spun out of every...
It's the measuring tape.
It is. I cannot imagine, though, that any of them thought that the battleground would be... Not in that there is so much RAM, but that we would be having these ridiculous... firestorm arguments over how it's allocated, over dynamic allocation of system resources, or the allocation of resources in an environment running several virtual machines. Like, man, they don't even want to talk to you about that stuff on the enterprise end of things. Microsoft doesn't. Microsoft doesn't like to expose a lot of that information to people who desperately need it for their jobs. I can't imagine any of them thought, like, we absolutely, guys, we got to have our message together on resource allocation for...
You could have stopped it. We got to have our message together.
Right. But what I'm saying is, like, somebody at some point said, we got to have a spec sheet that we can produce and show when we announce the console. Nobody said, man, you better pin down where you stand on resource allocation because...
That's going to be an asterisk.
Because it's going to be a big deal. I almost feel bad for these guys trying to anticipate what exactly is going to get lit on fire when and from what direction. And until someone from NeoGAF is personally given a tour behind the scenes of the sausage making of putting together a PS4 and has Mark Cerny, you know, describe in intimate detail how everything works, and then okays that person to go publish their findings in a long form article. And even then, who knows? Someone will make hay of it. But it's difficult. I know this requires like a kind of a rejiggering of our understanding of maybe what the different advantages were. You can make an argument for the fact that now that they're kind of at parity in terms of what's going to be available, that's maybe even better. I don't know. I just don't think it's anything particular to worry about. And I haven't seen any devs who seem worried. And we're living in a time now where any developer with half a mind can, you know, start some garbage online about something he doesn't like. So,
very much so, but at the same time can also be muzzled into not saying anything.
Yes.
About what that is. So, yeah, 50-50 kind of situation where maybe, maybe not sort of thing. But anyway, that's what we know on Sony's PS4 RAM usage. Interesting topic. That's what we know about Microsoft's Xbox One RAM usage. So there you go. Next week, we'll talk about what kind of internals operating will we talk about next
fan
week?
Fan speed.
Fan speed, exactly.
Next week is fan speed.
Fan speed and fan noise. The dBs are the difference. So anyway, we're going to take a break and come back with our second hour of in-game chat. We will be right back. And welcome back to In-Game Chat. Had some guesses. Actually had no guesses in the chat room. Nab thought it Pokemon, but he
I'm
was...
I'm guessing why there's random thumps in this track.
It's a game called Lost Cities.
Lost Cities?
Lost Cities. Doesn't ring a bell for me either, and I put the thing in. I don't know where I got it from. It's got the listing of Evav Dash... name of the game. So this was way back when that went in, so I have no idea what that was, but somebody I'm sure in the chat room or listening on the radio or on iTunes whenever they hear this will know exactly what we're talking about and be like, that's the greatest track I've ever heard. Speaking of, we're thinking of doing an entire show dedicated to video game music. We will give you more details about that on our Steam group and through Twitter and on our Facebook page. We'll give you all the details about that. We're not exactly sure when we're going to be doing that, but we're thinking about doing an entire show dedicated to music and playing a lot more music than doing a lot more talking. So
when we do a couple of shows based around that.
I think
that
so. I mean, yeah.
With a couple of different ideas. But if anybody out there has any specific subset of music that they enjoy more than anything else or don't really see something represented or you know what? This is a radio station. Treat it like a request hour or something.
In a sense, yeah. Don't go nuts and send me 20 tracks and say, you know, play these or anything like that.
Send the 20 tracks. Just don't go nuts if they don't all get played.
Right. Or do it that way. Yeah, exactly. We'll try and get that on for you is the best way I can tell you how that works. But if you do send us some tracks, please be very specific as to, like, what the track is and from what game it's from, and the composer, if you can get that information, that would be great. But you can send it to us. You can send it to me, Scott, at ingamechat.net, or everyone at ingamechat.net. Send it to everybody so that everybody knows what we are getting. But anyway, don't know yet when that's going to be coming about, but we'll keep you posted and let you know. Moving on, going over to, in fact, somebody, I believe somebody said in the chat room that they really wanted us to talk about this, and it's specifically... what Activision did this week to kind of break away from Vivendi. In fact, I think earlier before this happened, there was rumor that Vivendi was going to be dipping into the Activision Blizzard account to like, hey, we
Vivendi's been in poor shape for a while. So just as so many other mega corporations, large media conglomerates are, they are not self-sustaining in a very good way. The huge portions of their mass aren't really, you know, are nothing but costly. They aren't really generating any money. And for various reasons, which should be obvious to everyone in the world, Activision Blizzard prints money like a two for one. They just make money. They had squillions of dollars in cash just sitting around.
Vivendi wasn't doing so bad years and years and years ago.
Lots of people weren't doing so bad years and years ago. That's why they became mega corporations. Mm-hmm. That's why they became conglomerates.
Yeah.
They were doing so well, they were so flush with cash, that one of the only obvious avenues for further growth and investment was not to turn your money inward and create a new portion of yourself that competes with someone else. Rather, you take your money and you go buy the someone else that you're interested in. That was how it was done. Still is done in a lot of ways. It's just that that's not happening now because of stuff. But that's what they did. They just went around gobbling up everything. And anymore, that isn't the best way to go. But as a single company, Activision Blizzard is in fantastic shape. I mean, World of Warcraft just bled off another 500,000, 600,000 subscribers.
Right, yeah.
In like 3 months, you know? And they're still just money's just coming out of them.
Yeah, there was no dent in that bucket that happened. Yeah.
No, I mean, when you start losing subscribers, you are losing revenue that you have counted on. That is a mm-hmm. drop in revenue. But their cash reserves, right? The amount of money they just were sitting on is huge. And Vivendi was going to say, you got too much money. It's not doing me any favors. So I'm gonna force you to pay dividends out of that money. I'm going to force you to like pay back into the parent company some of that money.
The dividend was expected to be around $2 to $3 billion to pay the debts that Vivendi had.
Yeah.
It's interesting how this works. And six of the 11 Activision board members, they come from the Vivendi group or its units. So approval from Activision's board was very likely, which it's interesting to say that if there was six of the 11, then there was some way the decision was made that, no, we're going to, let's reverse that. Let's just, what do you want? How much for us to get out of this?
Yeah.
What do you want? Name your price. And apparently the price was $5.83 billion.
Just buy you out.
Billion, by the way, billion dollars. That kind of amount is usually reserved for government talk.
Yeah. Now look, this is a part of the industry that is slightly fascinating, right? It's not really what we're about. It's not about playing games, at least not directly. But we bring these things up just to say that, like, these guys,
you don't get to say billion when you're talking.
These guys are huge. This industry is huge. We still think of it as a very intimate and personal thing, but it is gargantuan. It is enormous. I think it is very important to remember this kind of money when we think about what small things we all are, kind of shouting back up at the industry the things we love and we hate about it and wondering, why aren't you doing what I want you to do? Because billions, man. And that's just these guys. Granted, they're very nearly at the top of the game. And say what you want about the staple of games that they produce. The guys have managed their money very well. They've managed their properties to their properties are prosperous. Let's put it that way.
Well,
they are not as well loved as they once were, but they are very prosperous.
It gets even better because the $5.83 billion went to 429 million shares. Then an investor group, completely separate, an investor group that's led by the CEO of Activision, Bobby Kotick, and another guy, the co-chairman, Brian Kelly, they're paying $2.34 billion for 172 million shares, which gives them more control of the company. Now, so Activision Blizzard, they've got World of Warcraft, they've got the Call of Duty stuff. World of Warcraft alone, they're sitting on that money bin. Call of Duty is like, here's our pocket change that's coming in for us. The investor group that is led by the Activision CEO includes Tencent, which is the company that owns League of Legends.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Which is another
thing that makes money.
Mound of cash. Vivendi's going to retain a 12% stake in Activision and Blizzard. Before this, they held 61%. So that's all switched around. But yeah, so I mean, I've still I think the last Vivendi game that I have is my box copy of Half-Life 2.
Yep, mine as well.
Yeah. So that's the only
before they went off and decided to print their own money.
Exactly. God, Vivendi doesn't have is not having a very good time holding on to their groups. I guess
no,
you could say.
Well, I mean, they've put themselves in a position and they've helped foster and create and given some amount of, early amount of cash to these people to help them get to a place where they could do what they did. I think it's probably very good. I know that a lot of times, again, cynically, we all have decided that it's corporate interest that governs every little thing that we can't stand about our games, right? That the direction of WoW has gone is like Mr. Vivendi's fault. You know, I don't like what WoW is doing. It's too casual. It's all about making money for Bob Vivendi so that, you know, whatever, so that he can be fine, right? Mm-hmm. There's maybe some like grain of honest observation there or something. But I think it's interesting now that they are their own thing. They are very much their own beast. They are not beholden to any other company that isn't purely about video games. Right now, Activision Blizzard, which does one thing, it activizes and it blizzards. Like, they do their thing, man. They are not doing, they're not, they don't do productivity software, you know, any of that stuff. They make video games. And now they are completely in charge of their destiny. That's interesting to me. I would like to be optimistic about that and say that, you know, being independently owned and that wealthy and that focused on video gaming is a very, very, very good thing just for everyone interested in anything they might be producing. I can say whatever I want about the bad blood between me and Blizzard and their games, but I'm always going to care what they're coming out with next. I'm always going to care. So I'm not always going to care about Call of Duty.
Right.
I really care about Destiny.
It didn't WoW get an in-game market?
Are you talking about the cash shops? That's still experimental.
Okay.
They're still moving around with that. They're starting in other markets, and they're going to, which actually isn't entirely true. They already have cash shops. It's just for cosmetic goods.
Hmm.
It's just for things that don't directly affect the game. You know, silly little pets, funny mounts. I don't know, weird stuff you can wear in your character. I don't do those things, but they already make tons of money off of that when they start selling useful gear or access to a way to get that gear. You know, when they start selling access to statistical advantage, which they will at some point, they are going to make probably more money. They'll drive some people off, but there are already plenty of people who are willing to spend real money on the game outside of the monthly subscription.
And when we talk about this whole thing of making money, Navid in our forums over at Colony of Gamers had an interesting question. Do you think that the trading card market that Steam was using could be a type of test bed on Valve's part for a potential digital game resale market?
Oh, I don't know. That's a really good thought. I didn't think about it like that. I didn't actually think about it very much until I just kind of spasmodically sold all of my cards off one night. I was like, whatever, it's in my inventory, right? And that's like that's like an inventory in an MMO. I have to get rid of that stuff. I have to sell it off, right? And I show up to a vendor or something and just sell all my garbage off that I can't equip. So I did all that and paid for something. I think I paid for like one $5 type of game, and I just wasn't even considering it as an actual market thing, despite the fact that they completely exposed like the trend in pricing for any individual thing. You know, you could click on it and just see like what the pricing had actually done.
Yeah, once a week I go in there because I'm still holding on to some of my extra cards from the summer sale thing, and I just like, let's see what the market looks like, and I'll hit sell, and see where it's at. And I'm like, nope, I'll hang on to them. That's not enough yet for me to put it on there because I feel like they're going to go up eventually. I feel like those cards are going to go up when the winter sale comes around and there's going to be a badge and people are going to be looking at their badge progress again and say, oh, whoa, I need to finish that and then go and try and find the cards. That's when it maybe go up, whatever the case. But it's interesting to think about maybe being a test bed for doing resales of digital copies of games. Unless there may be some type of rules implemented, I don't see that being the case. Just for the fact that the saturation of how many cards were out there, you can see when you go to the statistics of a certain card, how it just dropped because the market kept getting flooded with them, and people wanted to sell these things off, and so they'd look at whatever the price was at the time they were trying to sell and drop it just 1 cent. But then everybody else would start doing it, and it just kind of drove that price down. I don't necessarily think that we're seeing or that we would see a market flooded with copies of Bastion that would drive that price down. Unless there's some kind of rule where it's like, well, here's the baseline you can sell it for. You know, you can't go below that.
I think you're right. I don't think the pricing would be as demand-driven.
Right.
I don't think so. Otherwise, yes, every game that anybody has ever finished and has no intention of going back to, they'd be throwing on the market. You'd be seeing...
It'd be a summer sale every day.
Yeah, it would be. No, I don't think that's their intention. I'm not even sure if that's what he's talking about. It's just that the mechanism for selling these cards could be some level of experimentation on Valve's part to see how... A further experimentation on their part to see how traded goods work and to see what the effect are and to see what the supply and demand relationship is at some points regarding certain things. But they're still dealing in collectibles, things related to to the metagaming of buying games on Steam.
And really probably cost them no money to generate. Or to to get out there. So Matt in the chat room says a consumer group is suing Valve in the European market to force them to add the ability to resell games.
Yeah, that's not terribly surprising. I think we've actually been waiting on that for some time. There's been a little bit of irritation in the EU market, or maybe what I'm thinking of is even specifically in the UK. But they have consumer rights and protections over there that we don't have over here. These things aren't really well organized at an international level, right? We each have national concerns, and we treat our pricing and trade for a lot of things as internal problems, not international problems. And so here in the States, yeah, forget about it. There's no avenue of attack necessarily for you to take as a consumer saying, I should be able to resell this good. No. Our people over here have been very clear. You are simply buying a license to use this stuff. The license is not transferable. Be quiet, you know. And I'm sure people will continue to go after that concept, and the idea legally will be redefined or refined over time. Mm-hmm. But my understanding, and it's a weak understanding, so I apologize, but is that there are very specific protections over there that say, nope, sorry, that's not how it works here. And just because your terms of service or your end user license agreement says that you are merely leasing or selling a license, I'm sorry, we have laws and we have national and union rules over here that say that you can't do that. Our law takes precedence over your terms of service and your EULA. So you must find a way to make the license transferable and saleable on a secondary market. I've understood that has been coming for some time because those rules have been in place for some number of years over there, and that it's just it's a complicated thing. It's a very difficult thing to kind of assault that position, you know. There's no good legal precedent, and the law has a tough time working its way through a position where there is no precedent. The first time through, a legal challenge is very difficult.
Yeah.
or any unknown waters is very difficult.
Because it's got to set that precedent.
You have to set the precedent. First, you have to make the first decision where some of this stuff is, and everything has to be challenged for the first time.
Yeah, and you'll have to understand that this decision is going to be looked back upon for everything else that comes up in this.
Right.
So let's
past
make
decisions
sure we get this right.
Are probably one of the most important things in law. Which is sometimes why the first challenge is so slow in coming, that everybody really wants to make sure they understand how things are going to work. And if it can't possibly be resolved without suit. So, I don't know. There's also no way that that does not have an effect on us over here. Some effect, whatever it is. We are unlikely to get the benefit of whatever they win if they were to challenge it and force someone like Valve to open up a secondary market. They may actually suffer for it. Truth be told, there's a possibility they could suffer for it because the participation on the Steam Store is completely voluntary.
Yeah.
So publishers could start saying, yeah, you know what? We're not going to participate in the different tiers of the EU environment. We're not going to sell in Europe, or at least we're not going to do it through Steam.
Right.
We're going to go somewhere where you
pull
have
our game from Steam
and sell it in some other way. I mean, again, that's unlikely because then you're just choosing to not do business at a certain level. But you see here, there's interesting possibilities. So the idea that Valve are thinking at some level about secondary markets and how they could possibly work. Again, we talked about it previously. They went and they bought a pet economist.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know,
let him run about the house having good ideas. So.
Yeah, well, this situation came up when, before Microsoft reversed their policy type situation, when they were trying to possibly have some way to trade in your games through mm-hmm. their marketplace on the Xbox One, before they switched everything around and said, nope, you can now use your used games and everything, and you can now go buy used games and everything else. So something like this is obviously being looked at and considered and tossed around as a possible real thing.
Yeah, they're well ahead of us on this. This is all, again, just more of us trying to catch the scent, you know, of what they might be up to and have our best guess at it and hope that maybe we're right. Maybe we understood something about what they're doing. But they're on it at some level.
Yeah. I had an update on the Forza 5 situation. We talked about it last week where the game was not going to be completely ready in time for its launch and that you would have to download the rest of it. Obviously, because it's got to go through, I say going gold. Usually when a game goes gold, it's ready to be shipped. And you could argue the definition there of what that means. But it has to go through all these processes in order to start getting, you know, mass pressings and then boxed and shipped and in the stores by launch day of the Xbox One, which is in November. We don't exactly know when, but they've already said that they're not going to have the game ready for that. So once it's done and sent off to press and boxed and shipped, they're still going to be working on the game right up until the time that you buy it, stick it in your Xbox One, and download the rest of it for you to play. They did say that the game will be playable out of the box with no connection. You can play it. I don't know how much of it you can play. They just said that at some point you will need to connect to finish the career mode. Not sure how much you're going to have to download for that. Not sure what it's going to entail. But the entire game still will not be on the disc that you buy in stores. And this is not a situation of there's DLC on the disc and it'll unlock later. It's the fact that game is not going to be... the single player is not going to be finished on that disc. You're going to have to download to finish your game. I want to say it's the first time anything like this has ever happened.
That was the case already, though, right? What is it that they clarified? They had already said that the game was going to be incomplete as shipped on the disc.
Clarified was that it would need to download. It would need to download the first time you put it in. He related it again to a refrigerator where you have to put stuff in it in order to play it and that sort of thing.
They shouldn't do that.
I know they shouldn't. We talked about that last week. But yeah, I think the clarification was that you can't finish the game the way it is out of the box, but you don't actually have to download something immediately when you start it up. You can play it offline when you first buy it if you want to. So
that's I really wish I understood better. Right, not was a better guesser, but legitimately understood a little bit better why this is the case. We are still ages away from shipping that game.
Yeah.
I mean, ages in whatever sense, right? We're significantly far out from the shipping of the disks. Mm-hmm. How is it at this point that we cannot change the nature of where the data is stored? If we have changed the policy of the console on which it's being played, why can there be no significant change in how the bit delivery system is going to operate? It is a disk. If I was going to download and buy the game purely from the digital store, which I'm sure I can, right? All of that information will be available to me there.
Yeah.
If I eschew the disk and say, no, thank you, sir. I am here for your digital future. I will have one, please. And I can buy the game, download the game, put it on my hard drive, play it. If I say, no, 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 I am one of those people who you were answering when you did your 180,
mm-hmm.
and you changed policies, I will take a disk, please. Right? It's like they are still somehow, for whatever reason, and I do believe there is a reason, they are unable to simply give me all of my bits on plastic. Right? Because that's really all we're talking about here. It's just give me everything on plastic. Let me do a day one, I guess, check again, sort of, although we've talked about not doing that either. I just cannot quite get my head around what the problem is. Have you already made some kind of decision that the game absolutely must ship on a single disc, on a single piece of plastic, and that everything that was there would require more than that? That also doesn't exactly make a lot of sense, because even under their old scheme, you still would have been able to play it.
Right.
I don't know. And I'm very aware of how little I know here, because of how little what they're saying actually makes sense to me. I'm not saying they have no reason. I'm not even saying they're being shady. Kind of being shady, but I'm not, you know what? I'm definitely not saying it's only them.
Right.
They're just the only people talking about it right now.
Right, exactly. They're the only people who have spoken up.
I'm just trying to figure out why can they just push it back? Can they not afford to do that? Or we just still, that still goes.
No. They need that game out like now for the one. Launch titles, man. They may not look like much. They may not amount to a whole lot in the grand scheme of things, but there are people making decisions based on launch titles and titles that come out in the launch window.
And it's
in those first weeks and months.
It's also a first-party launch title as well.
You know, it is an exclusive.
Okay. You've got plenty that are carrying over. You got Ubi's Watch Dogs, which will be on all major systems. Assassin's Creed 4, I almost said 3, will be on all those systems where it can, you know, do that. But Microsoft themselves need that. They need that there. Because it is a first party. I'm trying to think of other first party titles from Microsoft, but for launch on the Xbox One, and I'm completely drawing a blank.
Directly from Microsoft?
Yeah, directly from them. I'm completely drawing a blank.
Microsoft Studios. I don't know. The only the picture of the Xbox One at any given moment is basically Forza, Rise, and Titanfall.
Yeah. So,
which is unfair, of course, really. When you consider the studios that are making them,
mm-hmm.
it's more about, you know, some other things that are not really that interesting.
Well, and Titanfall being a launch title for the, well, I think, is that the launch title for the Xbox One? Anyway, it's not exclusive necessarily to the Xbox One, as it will also be on PC.
Exclusive to Microsoft platforms.
Right. Exactly. That's what that is. But Forza is that console. It will not get, as far as we know, a PC release. They haven't done that with the others. So anyway, we're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we get the final segment of In-Game Chat. We will be right back. And welcome back to In-Game Chat. Any guesses? I don't think any of you guys are going to know this, but you may.
No.
No, I thought about Streets of Rage, but that's all. No.
No, it's not. This is Pinball Effects.
Okay.
Huh. Yeah, so it's the main menu music for Pinball Effects, Xbox Live Arcade, which is now on Steam and everything else. So, and it's on the PSN, PlayStation Network Store, the apps for your iPhone and your iPad and your Android and everything else. So. Anyway, pinball lovers, welcome back to the show. We got 30, a little less than 30 minutes left of the show. I don't know. Anybody played anything? I played Witcher today. First time I played it probably since 2 weeks, maybe, or a week ago. And I finally moved into chapter 4. There are 5 chapters and then an epilogue to play. So I'm getting closer and closer to wrapping that up. It actually feels kind of nice to be like, I've had you for this long and I'm about to be done with you.
Yeah.
I just
hope
nothing happens to where I'm like, oh, well, not going to play it anymore. I'm right there at the end. Not going to play it anymore. I don't know. Anyway, I got to chapter 4. It is moving a lot faster now that I've decided to, and there may be some hate on me from this, or for this from some people, but I'm not necessarily ignoring side quests. I'm just not grabbing all of them like I was doing. If I happen to talk to somebody, like when it throws you in a new chapter, sometimes you have no idea exactly what to do, and you'll see some you know, green name folks. Those are people you can talk to. They have a green name above their head. And you'll go and talk to them, and if they give a side quest, I'm like, okay, I'll take it. But I'm really trying to stick to my primary quests for each chapter. Otherwise, I'm not going to get that game done. I'm not going to get it done. So yeah, now I'm taking it as few side quests as possible, but really trying to get through the main story. I want to move on to Witcher 2. Let me tell you, I'm tired of looking at what I'm looking at for Witcher for the first Witcher. I want to move on to 2. So
I'm going to echo what Crimson in the chat room just said, because it is precisely what I was about to say to you, which is, as much as I enjoy seeing everything that a game has to offer, at least in terms of story, the subtler parts of a story, and knowing that even the main part of a story, the main plot, can be illuminated somewhat by side quests, I have come to the belief that I can no longer handle dealing with that many side quests. It feels horrible to me. I'm this guy. I am a man of destiny, out of legend. I am frightful and amazing and powerful, and I'm on a mission. I have a thing I got to do, right? I mean business. I am in your village or your town to smite an evil of some particular kind, right? And after about a half an hour spent with you people, I have 100. I'm doing your chores, right? Like.
Yeah.
I came to smite the evil. Could someone please point the way to the evil? No, wait, I'm sorry. I have to gather a bushel of apples right before I can smite the evil first, right? Because ultimately that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And I don't really mind the apples in altogether. I don't, but somehow it just seems to be, it seems like they're hung like ornaments, or they're hung like baggage. You know, Jacob Marley and his chains, right, are just sort of draped around me. Mm-hmm. Every person I meet, I begin to dread speaking with everybody in any village, on any space station, at any outpost, in any ruin. It doesn't matter. I see a bunch of people and my heart sinks, because what sort of crap are you going to have me do? What sort of stupid... God, there's a kid. I'm going to have to find its cat or its toy. Or it's something, just so its parent will talk to me and tell me where the mm-hmm. apple basket is.
Yeah.
So.
Lavo says that witchers are hired monster killers that need the money. You're exactly right, because every task I do, I never fail to mention, you're going to pay me for this, right?
Yeah.
Because I need the money. However, I've gotten it far enough into the game that... You know, it becomes a lot like Assassin's Creed, where you do need the money at the outset, but there's a certain point in the game where it's like, money is no object.
Sure.
I will pay you whatever because I have tons of
it. Now, see, you're talking about the practical need for money. He's talking about the fictional need.
The role-playing aspect.
I am a sword for hire,
mm-hmm.
you know? And, you know, sometimes there's dirty work that needs to be done. I understand. It's more to me about the way that the side quests are just sort of dumped on you in a lot of games. You just pick them up in the environment and in the area. They're not very dynamic or anything like that. And I'm not making a huge criticism about it. It's just my relationship to them. So at a certain point in a game, like The Witcher, which is a heavy thing, you know, a big game, you begin to just not so much care. Look, you have any idea how many apples I've gathered up to this point?
Yeah.
Forget your apples. Forget your crates of supplies. I don't care about your disagreement. I'm just going to go deal with this. Thank
now,
you very much.
This will completely change when I start Witcher 2, and I'll probably fall into the same trap again of just piling on too much that isn't necessary.
Well, but, and again, because they are very good. Side quests are a very good way at filling in backstory and side story, at shining light into all the dark corners of a world and its fiction and all this other stuff, you know, learning more about the characters you're dealing with in the main story, things like that. They are useful in ways other than just being time consuming and generating XP and money for the player.
So. And I may be the same way when it comes to Witcher 3. One of these things that I really long for in Witcher 1, however, I've been able to find ways around it as far as using the teleportation. It's just I need some fast travel in this. I've got three areas to travel between, you know, at some point around the beginning of chapter 3 or near the end of chapter 2 or something like that, you have like three different areas that you can travel back and forth to, and then you've got the sewers and the sub, you know, all these different places. And just what they're going to do in Witcher 3 is every place you can meditate from will be a fast travel point.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, and they're doing it in Assassin's Creed 4. I don't know if you watched that dev video, that viewpoints will now be fast travel locations.
Uh-huh.
So every viewpoint you get to, you can fast travel to that. So I'm fine with that. I you know, I love the aspect of you go and explore the world, but at some point after I have explored this entire world, I'm tired of looking at it, going back and forth. Just let me get there now. So the other aspect of Witcher is the, you know, waiting on the time of day for things to fall into place. So there's things like that. So anyway, making my way through it, I'm in chapter 4, I'm almost done with it, and I'm looking forward to finishing it up and starting Witcher 2. So there we go.
You still right now think you're in the mood to kind of roll directly over into Witcher 2, or are you going to take yourself a little bit of a break?
I'm not sure. I'm really itching to get into Witcher 2, because I know it looks better than Witcher 1, and it's got the combat mod for it and stuff like that, and I know it has some improvements over what I'm doing right now. And so I'm kind of interested in the story, because obviously this is a game that came from Witcher 1 that had lots of great things said about it. And then the improvements for Witcher 2, and then the console port type stuff where there's enough demand, let's put it on the console and that sort of thing. I'm very interested to see what they've done. So I'm kind of eager to jump into that. There's also not the slightest... There's a little bit of a yearning there for an feeling of accomplishment. I get that when I do these things, but you can't go and look at my Steam profile and tell where I'm at in Witcher. You can with Witcher 2 because they added achievements in there, and you can see this is how far he's come and that sort of thing. People can see where I posted a screenshot today during my playthrough that would tell people, oh, he's in chapter 4, or at least people that had played the game that would know, oh, he's in chapter 4. I remember that scene, but... there's no way for you to track my progress of what I'm doing, and no way for anybody to come in and send me a message or anything saying, hey, I see you just got that. You're at this part. You got some great stuff coming up. Or what did you do at this decision-making point? I have nobody to talk to on that.
Yeah.
So, and I know people are watching my Steam
thing. No, people do. This is one of the reasons that it's really fun to have friends, because they can, you know, and if you get online and expose yourself to that, I started up Dark Souls today for the first time.
Yeah, I noticed some people in the chat room noticed you did
that.
Yeah,
and I knew the minute that I did that, I was like, all right, here we go. I've got, you know, 30-something friends online at the moment. One or two of them probably took note of the fact that I finally
did this.
They just
saw you made that commitment.
Yep. It's like, all right, I can't say that I've done it and not have actually done it.
Well, apparently RJ over there is playing it on the PC.
RJ
apparently
did it as well.
Yeah, first time.
God, I guess that means when I'm done with Witcher, I need to jump into Dark
Souls. Well, that was going to be my suggestion. I really wanted everybody to kind of take a whack at it.
I can do that.
All at once.
All of us suffer together.
I guess I, you know, with the minor changes, and apparently you weren't even aware of this. The port to the PC was dreadful. It was barely a port at all. I mean, it was dreadful. It didn't run in a proper resolution on the PC. It had a horrifying frame rate. The image quality was just really, really bad. There were a number of minor problems that should not have been present at all. It just was a bad port in terms of presenting itself to that platform. Let me say that. If you're going to make a PC game, you need to make the game appear at the proper resolutions on the PC. You need to make sure that the frame rate is unlocked, and you need to make sure that anti-aliasing and simple things like that can be enabled. That's what was not done correctly. The game seems quite stable to me, what little bit I've actually played. So in that respect, I guess the port is quality. But anyway, there are simple fixes, very, very straightforward, very simple, easily user editable fixes available for the PC version of Dark Souls. And they are beyond recommended. They are, it's really hopeful that they would be considered sort of a default thing that you do when you put Dark Souls on your PC. So they help it out immensely. And it ran and looked pretty good to me. I felt really, really good about it. I felt perfectly, perfectly fine about it.
I'll have to jump on that as soon as I get a chance.
I don't know how, I mean, you do, you have said, have an older PC.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But in any case, you should check it out. And anybody who plays it on the PC should check it out. Mm-hmm. But DS Fix, I believe, is actually what it's called.
Okay.
Yeah, but Stufu just mentioned that in the chat room. DS Fix exists, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I didn't play a ton. I didn't have as much time as I would have liked, but I did decide to sit down and give it about an hour because that's what I had available. And I did. And I don't know. It's sort of hard to examine your own thoughts about a game when you've done more thinking about it than playing it, right? Because we've all been thinking about and talking about the game and its the aura that surrounds it for a really long time. But it plays good, right? If that makes any sense. It plays cleanly and it feels responsive. And I didn't, I always had this sense in my head that it wouldn't feel responsive, that it would feel sluggish or kind of dumb, and that I would be fighting the game all the time. If anything, it actually feels a little bit too fast, or faster than what I expected.
Mm-hmm.
I expected it to be a much sloggier, heavier game, and it doesn't really feel that way. So I'm fighting my expectations there. And I have no idea what to do. I have no idea. I've not read a this is what you do thing. I made a warrior guy. He's a guy. He has a sword and a shield. That's what he has. So I made that guy. I don't know if that's the guy I should have made. There were like 12 kinds of guy. Right? But, well, I mean, warriors make sense. Yeah. I don't care what game you're in. I'm wearing armor. I have a shield and I have a long sword. Mm-hmm. I know what that dude's job is. I know what he's capable of. But when you present to me some variation on the magic user or a caster, it's kind of tough for me to get my head around what you think that means, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure, I get it. What's your idea of a conjurer, say, right? Because in this game, it's a bit of a Healy type thing. In this game over here, it's kind of an indirect damage dealer type of thing. So I'm always really suspicious of magic using classes in games that I haven't researched a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even that, like, sword and board, you know, straightforward armored warrior is my favorite thing in the world. It's just, I am pretty sure I can guess accurately what that guy's going to be about in the game. So that's what I chose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know.
And, look, I mean, the way the characters work, from my understanding, you know, everybody's got the same stats. It's just different. It's just a lot of differently depending on the classes you play. I mean, if you level up enough, I mean, anybody can do magic or conjuring. I mean, you're a warrior. Play enough time with him, you'll be casting magic spells in no time.
I don't know that I want to do that.
Well, if you don't want to do that, you can just put in whatever stat you want whenever you level
up. I'm
going
to put my stats in my sword, and I'm going to sword things some more, or maybe.
Okay. Be a mega, maybe I'll get a specialist. Yeah.
I have no idea, dude. I have no idea. I have no idea what I'm doing. I mean, I understand basic stat allocation in RPGs. I understand how this stuff works. I don't, and I have read a little bit online about resistances aren't useful. Don't worry about those. Go for this other thing over here. This is a waste. That's not a waste.
You're getting plenty of advice in the chat room.
Am I really? Well, I'll have to scroll back when I get an opportunity.
Yeah.
But again, at the outset, and I'm just at the outset. I went through the introduction.
Right.
It was a big thing. Smashed my face in. But only the first time.
Yeah. Let me ask you this right quick. Do you recall how many times you died within that hour?
Okay.
Fun topic.
Roughly, I do. I think I died eight times.
Okay.
Seven times. Seven times I died. Seven times.
Seven. Do you remember the reasons?
The first time I died was in the intro when you have to... There's the demon, the behemoth type thing that's in the whatever the prison area when you're first getting out of there.
Yeah.
And you kind of walk through the doorway, right? And it loads you into his room, and I'm sitting on a ledge, and I look down, and he's like looking up at me with his face, like from way down there, and I was like, ah, hey buddy, like what do I do in here? Like what's And then as I'm hanging to myself, he like smashes the ledge I'm standing on, and I fall down and then bang myself real hard and had no health.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm running around and I got him almost dead. And then he smashed me to death. And then I figured out how to drink potions. I did not know how to drink the potions. And so I kept going like down on the thing. I was like, but the potion is in the down slot. And I'm pushing down and it won't. So anyway, I made a mistake. I did not understand what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I died the first time. The other six times, after you get through the tutorial area,
right,
and you get into the place where the bird, I don't know what's going on there. Well, there's a bird. There's a really large bird that grabs you.
Yeah, big bird takes you someplace else.
And he takes you someplace. That's literally what happens. That's all I know about what happens is this really big bird. He grabbed me and he took me somewhere else. And so I'm in the somewhere else, whichever this place was.
Lordran.
Sure. And there's some ways that you can go. You can go this way or you can go this other way.
Yep.
Three
spots, left, right, or back behind you. Yeah.
Right. And so I went left. Okay. And that's, there's
What reaction does that give you, RJ?
What's that?
He goes left. Are you going to say, oh...
I went to the grave. There was a graveyard. I was like, man, this is a cool looking like graveyard.
Exactly. Lavo says, oh, that's no good.
Right. Yeah, well, that's what I was like, which way am I going to go? This, I don't know, man. But the game looks like it's built for a guy like me. Lots of exploration, lots of little nooks and crannies, lots of dangerous places to.
Yeah, pretty much everything in Dark Souls, you're going to find out everything through exploration and talking to folks.
And that's
wise, where to go, things like that.
So I'm fine with that. So I went
left.
First,
you're guessing. You're just guessing at this point.
Right.
Yeah,
because he's like, there's something about bells. I got to ring a couple bells.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And there's a bell up and a bell down. And I was like, I don't know, man.
Down is
I'm just gonna go
down. God.
Well, see, I don't know. So I go over to the left, and I'm like, oh, there's some already dead stuff on the ground. I'll be fine.
No.
And then so the already dead stuff gets up, and then it kills me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to go back over there and grab myself off of the ground, all my souls that I dropped on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So I go over there. And I'm like, I can take these guys. I just messed up because I couldn't remember which button did what. I'm fine. So I go over there and I wasn't fine. And then I go over there like four more times. And I was like, that's it. I'm checking out. I'm done with this. I think the very last time I went and I grabbed my pile of souls.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm going to run away. Maybe they won't chase me.
They chased you, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They chased me. So I stopped doing that and then I went the other way.
Mm-hmm.
I went up for a while. And that was fine. I didn't have any problems going up.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then I remembered I read something once on a forum somewhere about idiot noobs that go to the graveyard. And I was like, wait a minute.
I wouldn't call them idiot noobs.
Man.
They just, like, well, you just don't know. And you'll find out the hard way, which is everything in this game. You'll find out everything the hard way in this game.
So I did that, but I had no problems going the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Not really. I was being very careful, but I didn't have any problems really.
Mm-hmm.
Do you plan on now? Are you gonna keep at it on Dark Souls? Are you gonna have something off to the side that you're gonna get to outside of your MMO Guild Wars stuff?
I don't think I can do Guild Wars anymore.
Okay.
By the way, I need something else. I'm really itching. Look, I know that maybe it's not great, but I'm really itching to play Final Fantasy XIV. I really want that to come out, and I'm just sort of idly playing with whatever MMO I happen to have available, anything that's free to play. I play with Guild Wars a little bit, but it's lovely, but it's just not, this doesn't take its job very seriously, in my opinion. So I can't spend too much time there. I've spent the last couple of weeks playing it. I would like to play some more Dark Souls, just because... I would like to give people the opportunity to laugh at me once a week.
I'll be joining you very soon.
That'd be fun.
As soon as I get done with Witcher, I will jump into Dark Souls and see what that does to me.
I'm tired of it being a mystery, right? The Witcher is something that I feel like playing. I feel obligated to play it because I'm very interested in continuing with the series. But Dark Souls is somehow a stack of really weird stories that other people tell each other that make no sense to me because I have no frame of reference for it. And I'm a little bit tired of not having that frame of reference. Mm. I want to at least be in the mix and in the know with other people.
So you didn't get a chance to experience the joy of someone cutting into your game trying to engage you.
I did not.
Yeah, because you said you died against the Chaos Demon in the jail, in the tutorial section. And I take it you didn't go back to human form at the bonfire.
No.
I didn't even know
that I could.
Yeah. Well, you know, but yeah, because I don't think, no one can invade you while you're still in hollow form. They only invade you when you're in human form. So you didn't have to experience that. Because my experience, my first time playing through on PC and Steam, someone did invade my game. Unfortunately for whoever was invaded, I got to the boss, so I didn't get to face him. He got kicked out of the game.
Have you ever invaded somebody's game? Are you given a prompt for that, or is it just a random?
It's an item that you have, a red eye orb, I think is one, or you have a red, so certain items you have that will allow you to invade other people's realms.
It's a conscious decision
you willingly have to do that.
Okay, gotcha.
Set yourself up to help someone out or invade someone's territory, invade someone else's world and take their souls and humanity.
Well, we've only got a few weeks left before things really start to ramp up as far as the games coming out. I mean, August holds lots of stuff. Mm-hmm. Splinter Cell Blacklist is one. Saints Row 4.
Dragon's Crown.
Dragon's Crown. XCOM. The Bureau, I think, is what that is.
Yeah.
It's about to get quite busy. In the next few weeks, DuckTales is coming out. I'm looking forward to that. I guess your Castle of Illusion, is that this month?
Yeah,
they
just said summer, so I haven't got a date yet. But
what is that?
Castle of Illusion? Is it Mickey's Castle of Illusion?
Castle of Illusion starring Mickey Mouse. It was a Sega game, early 90s or so, I believe. Yeah, basically a side-scrolling adventure game, but it was pretty enjoyable. And then they announced they were making a remake of that one. All I know is that it said summer. It didn't say when, but I'm looking forward to that one.
Probably very soon. So, anyway, August looking full. Then we jump into September, and that's GT6, I believe. Then October is Beyond Two Souls, and then everything else just falls.
There are
place.
Other things, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. GTA 5 is September, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Then there's
GTA.
That.
I think Final Fantasy 14, at least for me,
that's right.
Is also either. What is there? I don't know what the release date is. I'll have to look that up again. The final phase of beta, which is open and then consistent into release, is August as well.
Yeah. All right. Hey, what's this?
Mask?
It's the one you say all the time.
Oh, is this Mega Man?
This is Mega Man. Thanks, everybody, for joining us in the chat room, as well as everyone listening on the stream and even on the radio as well. Thank you to everyone who gets us every week from iTunes or however you get our show for later use. Why not throw up a review on iTunes? We'd love to hear what you think about the show. We'd love your honest. We're not gonna quit. We promise. We're going to keep doing this. We really appreciate it. Don't forget to join us on Twitter, Facebook, and our forums at ColonyOfGamers.com. And if you're on Steam, we've got a Steam group you can join up with over there and play games with us and other listeners. We give away games, we trade cards, we do all that stuff. And check out our Minecraft server at play.ingamechat.net. Thanks, everybody. We will see you next Saturday.